This is Dr. Charles Parker, and you're listening to Core Brain Journal. It's the place where I connect both fresh discoveries and interesting different perspectives from advanced mind science with the realities of real people and everyday life down on Main Street. Well, welcome, folks. Here we are once again at Core Brain Journal for episode 035, and we've got an interesting person who is going to help us understand how kids can actually learn to better take care of themselves, even within their own peer group. Dr. Jennifer Fried, Executive Director of AHA out in Santa Barbara, California. Welcome, Jennifer. Really happy to have you on board.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be on a show with this type of information and integrity.
Thank you. It's going to be so much fun talking to you. I mean, I just loved the little bit that we were talking about. I think our listeners are going to be interested where the rubber meets the road do you call it AHA?
Yes. We coined AHA before Oprah put her AHA moment into her magazine. So AHA was actually the name given by a student for the experience they had of waking up to their best self, which is AHA. I get it now.
Love it. Love it. And so then it became an acronym for?
Attitude, harmony, and achievement. If we have a positive attitude and we can increase social harmony, then all of us can achieve our contributions and dreams in society.
So well said. Really, I'm going to do a little intro and then we'll talk more about your project out there. So Dr. Fried is a psychotherapist, a mediator, and an author with over 30 years experience working with youth and deep roots in the Santa Barbara area. Tough place to be living in, I'll tell you. My son lives out in Topanga, so we get out there once in a while.
Well, we are beyond blessed with one of the most naturally beautiful places in the country. But what a lot of people don't know is that the gap in terms of income is as severe as you can get in this town between the extraordinarily wealthy and the very, very poor. And so we have a real good mix here of all the issues that face the rest of the country.
Thank you. I would never have known that. So just a little more further, Dr. Fried began at age 19, if you can imagine that, running a peer counselor training program at one of the local high schools. And shortly thereafter, she began working with YouthWorks, which was connecting students for mission trips and community service activities, even abroad. So she's had some significant experience for a long period of time. Then what happened is in 1999, after the Columbine massacre, she started the AHA organization with a colleague, Randy Friedman, who became co-executive director. And so she's been actively involved with students at the high schools in Santa Barbara, has an after-school program. And one of the things I think is going to be really interesting to our listeners is how you have really helped students find themselves internally to actually become mediators and interventionists on their peer group, as opposed to waiting for some adult to tell them what to do. So we'll talk about that in a second. I want to mention your books. You have several books. The Ultimate Personality Guide, Lessons from Stanley the Cat, sounds interesting. A series of Be Your Best Self workbooks, which they're used in the AHA programs. And she's finishing a book. It's going to be done in September. It's not EQ, it's not IQ, it's PeaceQ, a book about peace building. On a book on women's sexual wisdom, and another book about celebrating and transforming negative thoughts. Bad Thoughts, Gremlins is the name of that book. So she is a busy writer out there in Santa Barbara. Thanks so much for telling us about all those. So, Jennifer, what would you say would be the biggest challenge you had as you were facing the concept? You had the experience as a young woman. What was the big challenge that you had in moving it forward to actually develop the group that you currently have?
That's easy. When we started AHA, and even when I've been passionate about social and emotional learning back even 30 years ago, and it wasn't called that then, people thought of these skills as soft skills, not essential skills, but things that you could build later, maybe never even build, because what really mattered was that you made a lot of money, you passed the test, and you really excelled in practical things like math and science. Well, now, luckily, due to incredibly rigorous research and meta-studies, we know that social and emotional learning is fundamental, not just to people's sense of happiness and fulfillment, but also how well they actually do in life. So it's moved the dial from where I started, and it was always a passionate but difficult uphill battle to describe how important this was, to now people are begging us to bring our curriculum into their schools and out of school programs.
It sounds very, very interesting. And what was the impediment, though? Where did you hit the wall first when you started putting this together?
Well, I think the very first example I can give you is we started off as a summer program. We were put on the front page of the newspaper because it was so successful. Then we were asked into continuation high school. That particular class that we worked in saw such extraordinary results that then they wanted to put us in more continuation classrooms. But we were very lucky. The first classroom we were in was with a teacher that was all about personal growth and his own science of mind, if you will. But the second classroom we were put into, the woman was terrified of her own personal growth, very insecure about anything that was out of her control. And so as students started opening up and sharing and connecting in classroom and even having tears and emotional discussions, she thought of reasons for us never to come back.
Yes.
Because she was uncomfortable and she wasn't willing to look at her own issues. And, you know, she wanted, as many of us grew up in the paradigm of control over her students instead of collaborative learning.
Yes, that so often happens. Because if they can maintain control, they think it's all going to work out. They're going to get that academic training that they need. Otherwise, it's all frou-frou.
Well, we have vastly mistaken compliance for participation. And it's a really big difference. People are not participating when they're just following rules and putting their heads down and pretending that they're in accord with what's going on. Participation is really an exchange of ideas, and it's an emotional attunement. And so we have to really create an educational experience for young people that's about participation.
That is so much what's going on in medicine as well, interestingly enough, because we see that happen all the time with patients. I mean, I'm taking the subject back over to myself for a moment, but I mean, it really is a life practice. If people are respected for where they are and actually become a part of the solution as opposed to being driven to the solution, they overcome that passivity. They become more actively involved in self-regulation, self-management.
I couldn't agree more. And I think what's so important is that young people have a sense of agency in their lives, that they're working on something that matters to them and that they have a stake in, so that what actually occurs, they feel passionate about, but they also feel responsible for.
So true. Let's take a moment to take an example, if we can. I'm thinking about Columbine. First of all, did you find anyone in the course of your work with the students that really needed some specific acute attention and that perhaps a student unearthed, and what did you do about it?
We've had so many cases of that, but I'll bring up one in particular. I went in to do a presentation to a school of special needs young people, which at that point was just anybody that had behavioral problems. And there was a boy in that classroom during the presentation, and I hope your listeners won't be offended, that stopped me in the middle of what I was saying and said, "I hate you Jews. I want to kill you. I'm going to get the gays. I'm going to," like, you know, he just went off. And, you know, most people would just shut him down and kick him out of the classroom. But I said, "Hey, you know, you have a lot of anger, and I know that anger comes from real injury and hurt. So why don't we all take a moment and listen to where you got this kind of rage toward Jewish people, toward gay people? Let's just take a moment and really hear from you about where that started." And nobody'd ever asked the boy, of course. So he then started describing bullying incidences he had had when he was younger, and he attributed it to people that were different than he was, and he had, you know, learned this behavior of being dominant and aggressive as a way to ward off his own vulnerability. Mm. And here's what happened. Believe it or not, that was just a presentation about, you know, come to our out-of-school program if you want to. It's all voluntary. Well, 3 weeks later, that boy walked into my out-of-school program and said, I want to be here. So, you know, it's like it's in the moment practicing the compassion. It's not just a concept. It's even being compassionate with people that are expressing themselves with such hatred and rage. It's hard sometimes to listen, but I know now, and especially somebody that studies people psychologically, that we're not built as babies to be like this. This comes from learned and horrible trauma, so we want to understand it too.
What an evocative scene that was, and how so well handled. It's just, you know, it's easy to get stuck there. So let me ask you this. What happens when, can you give us an example of a student who then pulled themselves together, began to exert some internal personal responsibility, and actually did a mini intervention on another student? How do you have any examples of that sort of thing?
Yeah, I'm thinking of a young woman that came to us from Oakland because her grandmother got her out of Oakland because she was in gangs and she was using weapons, and her parents were both drug addicts and were not available. So she came to our out-of-school program at 16. She hadn't really gone to school. And she came every day. We have like a five-day-a-week program that you can go to. And her name's Leandra. And she ended up feeling like she had a new way of thinking about life. About 3 weeks in, she said, I don't know what's happening here, but you all like are about love. I've never felt it before. She was the first person to finish high school in her whole extended family. And then her brother was stabbed in an incident here. And she had been raised on violence and drugs. And it took everything in her to not only not extract revenge on the family, you know, that had been involved in the stabbing, but she had to work with her own brother to calm him down and to talk him through and the rest of her family so that they had a peaceful resolution to this experience instead of more violence.
See, that's amazing. I mean, to really imagine that a young person would begin to model that level of sense of responsibility within their own family is breathtaking, really. It's just fantastic.
Well, let me tell you that's one story, but we've now been for the last 3 years training hundreds of students in something we call AHA Peace Builders. They take a 10-hour training in how to be allies, how to interrupt bullying and hatred with humor and curiosity instead of more violence. We teach them how to lead and facilitate deep listening circles based on empathy and respectful sharing. And then they go ahead with a unique website that we've created called peaceq.org, where they document weekly the peace points they've been accruing and the positive behavior and the self-care and also the listening circles that they've created and what questions they're asking. And it is the most inspiring example of how ready and willing young people are to go out and be emissaries of peace building and culture building in their own schools and communities.
Well, that is surprisingly a brief period of time of training, to tell you the truth. I would imagine that, you know, when I was thinking about this same thing, because I've been interested in developing a program, who has time, but the issue is, how do you actually bring a person along who is a student to actually take that level of responsibility and to do it in that kind of brief time? How do you work that training program out? What happens?
Well, you're right. It's not just I was wrong to speak like that. It's not just the initial 10-hour training. Then we work with them all school year. It's part of a school club, and they meet every other week. And they're highly mentored. So our AHA formula, which we really have stuck to all these years is one adult per every eight youth, because we believe, and science shows us this, that most all learning is from modeling behavior. And mm-hmm. so if a young person doesn't like one adult, okay, but if there's six of them in the room of 30 people, there's a high likelihood there's somebody they're going to admire and want to model after. So in the AHA Peace Builders program, we always have a number of facilitators listening to them, helping them with their questions. We have a feedback sheet where people are telling us what things they're struggling with. So we keep in real close contact with these AHA Peace Builders, so they're mentored all through the year.
So then back to that picture, I'm trying to grasp exactly what you were saying because I want to imagine. So you might have a group of eight people with a mentor. And are those people all simpatico with that mentor? Or are they in conflict with that mentor? What were you saying about that point?
Okay, that's a great question. So imagine, if you will, in the training initially, there's 50 students per school, and there's about eight facilitators. So they're all working in small groups and large groups with the 50 students for the 8 to 10 hour training. Then in the school club, there'll be those 50 students coming biweekly. And in that club meeting, there'll be those same eight facilitators who are working with the students as they're asking their questions and going through their skill practices. So these are positive mentors. These are not disciplinarian. These are people working alongside the youth to develop their AHA peace building skills.
So then do you do role modeling then?
Yes.
People take turns role modeling and that sort of thing?
Yes, they come up with what are the things they're having difficulty with. I'll give you an example. In the first year of the AHA Peace Builders, the things the youth were running into the most is being teased and harassed by teachers for wearing their AHA Peace Builder t-shirt, or they were being made fun of, interestingly, from the adults. So they came in and they would tell the mentors, the students are really into this, but the teachers in some of our classrooms are making fun of us, or they're telling us we can't wear our AHA Peace Builder t-shirt. Yeah. And so then the whole group would brainstorm what are good strategies that are peaceful and enjoining to the teachers so that we can get them more participating in this whole program instead of feeling threatened by it. And everybody would join together to think of solutions and problem solving instead of it being like an adult telling the teen what to do, because that doesn't really work.
Well, that is so interesting. Then, do you have this program in other parts of the country? I mean, is it a program that somebody from Norfolk, Virginia could do with your program?
Well, it is replicable, although I will say, and I'm sure you're like this too, any good science-minded person, this is our third full year of doing it, and we have had to iron out a lot of kinks. Mm-hmm. It's at the place now where we have a lot of curriculum, a lot of research. We have expert trainers. We could transfer it to other locales, but what we've decided is people have to really want to do this on their own, and we'll bring technical assistance because we don't presume to know the demographics or the culture of other locales.
Right.
People have to do this as an inside job. So where we're at now is we were called to Michigan to do a keynote speaking there on what we're doing, and we've been asked to consult in Cleveland. We're at a place where we would like people to be able to access us as consultants if they want to build this in their own school district.
Yeah, that sounds interesting. I mean, it's almost like you have a weekend with adults who
exactly
want to do it and then take some responsibility for it once they've, because a person who wants to do it is going to be intuitively in tune with what you want to do in the first place. And then they'll be able to share that experience. It sounds very, very interesting because so many schools could use it. You think about what happens, because who's going to intervene on another student better than a student? I mean, to me, it's...
Yeah, like we have examples all the time. What we know now is it's the bystanders who are the most important people in stopping bullying behavior. So, for example, in the AHA Peace Builders, we teach them the people that are most likely to be bullied are the people that are most marginalized, most isolated, or most vulnerable. So make sure you're always hanging out with them. If you see somebody alone at lunch, or if you see somebody struggling in the hallway, you go up and you hang out with them. Don't make a big play of it, but just do the kind thing, because then they're much less likely to feel that alone and draw that kind of bullying attention toward them. The other thing is, if somebody starts to say racist, sexist, homophobic remarks, which people often do, other people start laughing. We've trained the AHA Peace Builders just to say something as simple as, hey, you know, that's not funny to me. Let's switch the subject to something more important or positive. Something like that, like nothing really heavy, nothing really sanctioning, because we don't want to rob people of having fun and teasing, and we don't want to get into this whole paranoid culture of every political correct word, but we do want people to be aware that words have impact.
Boy, it's amazing, because just that little subtle intentionality could change the whole moment for so many people. It's a very interesting example. You know, my own thought was, I started getting too deep into it, I think. The way you're talking about it, it sounds like it's deep, but it's actually much more operational than the way I was originally thinking about it. Because I was thinking about teaching and having a peer development for mediation, and actually having peers trained to be mediators, and actually then sit down with them and have one person talk to another person with a peer managing that dialogue. So that
you're not far off. They actually have a robust program of doing that in Colorado. I have a colleague that you might want to interview one time, and she's in Colorado. She's the head of restorative approaches in Colorado. There's a whole movement now with restorative approaches in the schools. And in her case, she's actually empowered students to do the mediation and the restorative practice. And in our case, we do train the AHA Peace Builders to sit in what's called restorative circles and help facilitate, although they're not the primary facilitator, that's still an adult. But what my friend Deb has said is that in Colorado, if youth get enough training, they can run these circles themselves. And I believe that's true.
Yeah, I think it's possible. I think it's a deep and it's a much more difficult I would imagine to manage and evolve that dialogue. Then, you know, you have such a very simple, basic, hey, this intervention can happen anywhere.
Not only can it does. And as you know, most of the unkindness in life is said on the fly, and it would be easily interrupted if people pivoted and just helped turn the conversation to something else. So we really also talk about negative gossip and rumors. Like, what is the right thing to do when people are starting to get really hot and excited about talking smack about somebody else is just to say, hey, that doesn't feel that good to me. Let's think about something positive, talk about somebody that we really admire. Just change the direction of the conversation.
Very interesting. Absolutely interesting. Give us an example, if you will. I just love your examples that you gave. Do you have another one where someone was troubled and was not handling themselves well, and a student intervention occurred that was successful?
Sure. Well, for example, on campus, there was a period of time, as there often is, when the young people were going out and getting very, very drunk at parties. And young men, it's very pertinent today, actually, were taking advantage of certain girls that were really, really drunk. And we had a whole circle about that after the weekend, about what can we all really do to support young men and young women not making unconscious decisions based on being inebriated around sexuality, because that's mm-hmm. a huge issue.
Yes, it is.
And we had the girls in the middle talking about their experiences at parties and what it's like to see their friends go off in a room when they're almost blacking out. And we had the guys listen to the girls talk about it. Then we put the girls in the guys in the center and had the girls listen to their experience of being hit on by really drunk girls, and what's their, you know, responsibility in that. And out of that, they came up with a lot of solutions about what they wanted to do when they saw people making poor decisions at parties based on being high or drunk. And again, it's up to them to think about how to handle this. We're not often there.
Yeah, that it's really, really amazing. So do you, in your books, tell us a little bit about your books. One of your books have a program for this? It looks like the Be Your Best Self workbooks. That sounds like the group of books that's most directed to engaging the students in this process. Is that true?
The Become Your Best workbook series is actually for youth, for families, for therapists, for educators, because any of us can go through the workbooks, one's character, one's compassion, one's relationship wisdom, and one's creative expression. And I designed them with my co-author, Amanda Lake, so that you could really go through a process of taking an initial test, you know, how am I doing on my character development or my compassionate development? And then going through the workbook, if you, I've had students take entire semesters at alternative schools and take the workbook from page one till the end and take an entire course on compassion and character, or you could pick it up just to get exercises to do with students. So it's really a multi-use type of approach with these workbooks. You can do them by yourself, you can do them with your family, you can do them in a classroom, and I meant it to be very portable in that way.
Sounds interesting. So is the Stanley the Cat for the younger population then? Is that, we were talking earlier.
No, that's a funny story. I loved my cat beyond belief, and when he died, I wrote a few friends the lessons I learned from him, and I meant it very seriously. Mm-hmm. One of my friends said, "This is a book." Next thing I knew, she got me an agent. It was all very serendipitous. And then I asked a friend of mine in Sweden, would she illustrate it? And it's actually kind of a profound philosophical book. It's like a cat's lessons translated through a psychologist. And it's not for children, actually, because there's some things around sexuality or sex. Mm-hmm. But it's really doing well on Amazon because there's nothing quite like it. And my friends say they just pick it up and read it, you know, every so often to remind themselves of what they really want to pay attention to in life. It's much more a quality of life type book.
Dr. Jennifer Fried, we are going to have links to every single one of your books. And I think it's going to be interesting to follow your work because this would be so life-changing for so many people. When you think about bullying, there are so many different aspects to it. Some people want to have a kick-butt anti-bullying situation. And it does very frequently come down from the adult population. Here's what we're going to do with these kids. And really, your ground-up approach is so refreshing, and it sounds like it's working so well.
It is working, and there was just a report, and I'm sorry I'm forgetting the source of it, but somebody very important just put out a report that said they now know that the no tolerance and the just say no and the heavy punitive programs are not decreasing bullying behavior, that it is only the peer-led programs and the social and emotional programs that are seeing real headway, and we're one of those initiatives. There's other great ones around the country, but it's just common sense. If you want to stop bullying behavior, it probably isn't the best idea to hate the bully because it just really creates more problems.
Yeah, it just perpetuates the whole situation, doesn't it? It's amazing.
It really does.
Well, Dr. Jennifer Fried, thank you very much for taking the time with us. Now, let's sign off with you telling our audience where they can go. This is episode 035, so we're going to have a download opportunity for them. That'll be, and we'll have all of your books in the show notes. So where could they go to connect with you?
I have a website, JenniferFried.com, spelled just like my name. And by the end of June, you'll be able to download at least one title for free, probably Character. And with the book giveaway, we're going to give away the AHA Method book, which is really state-of-the-art information on how to lead as a youth facilitator in a socially and emotionally intelligent way. But if you go to JenniferFried.com, I promise you there's going to be lots of things coming down the pike that are not only going to be useful, but very entertaining.
It's, you know, I'm taken aback because it sounds so doggone entertaining. You're thinking about how troublesome this is, and yet the way you present it is so positive and so affirmative. I really appreciate it.
And I will tell you, in case anybody's involved with youth programs, at AHA, everybody we hire has this positive attitude like me and loves their work and thinks of it as a calling. So we don't have youth being dragged to our programs. We are turning youth away all the time because they want to be where there is not just great learning, but real positive, joyful attitude. And that's what is one of the hallmarks of AHA.
Well, thank you so much. What a great close. I mean, I can see everybody rushing right over to your website right now because the curiosity is there. I'm going to be over there myself. I really appreciate it. I had the other website on your list here, but that one's going to be one we need to drive over and see what's going on.
Well, thank you so much for this opportunity, because what I'm most excited about is just having the world have more of a way to participate in something that is really positive and possible.
Beautiful vision. Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
You too. Thanks for listening to CoreBrain Journal. We're working every day behind the scenes to bring you reports that connect research benches with those street trenches. Here we share the complexity of mind science because, as you know, details really do matter. One of the most pervasive, misunderstood challenges is how commonplace medications, like those written for ADHD, are used so regularly without clear guidelines. If you think you'd like more specifics, take a minute to download my 2-page PDF packed with video links and references on the absolute essentials of how to start ADHD medications. They're easily available at corebrainjournal.com/start. Thanks for listening. Do connect and stay tuned. Together we can make a difference.